It's hard to miss that the relationships or the conflicts between young Black men and the police is very much an issue right now. So we have a story that flips the script that we've been hearing. If you are a basketball fan, then you probably know Caron Butler. The two-time NBA All-Star has played for some of the sport's greatest teams, including the Miami Heat, Los Angeles Lakers, and the Dallas Mavericks, where he was part of the 2011 championship team. He's currently with the Sacramento Kings. But what you may not know is the unusual route he took to get there, which included numerous arrests for drug dealing, a stint in prison, and a close call with a police officer that set the course of his life. He talks about all of this in a new memoir called Tough Juice, My Journey from the Streets to the NBA, and Caron Butler is with us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Tough Juice, you say that's the nickname one of your former coaches, Eddie Jordan, gave to you when he played for the Wizards because of you were so tough or because of the way you grew up was so tough?
Combination of both. You know, he learned a lot about my history and my character as a coach and me being as a player for 4 years at the time, playing through injury, playing through whatever adversity that was bothering me or whatever. I just played. I came, I showed up, I played, I laced them up. And he was like, you know, you tough juice. And it just kind of stuck. It's a good name to have.
So you're born and raised in Racine, Wisconsin, which I'm not sure a lot of people think of it as kind of one of those hardcore urban environments that, you know, some people come through. But for you, it was?
See, this is what you get in Racine. You get a mist of everything. You get the GDs, you get the Vice Lords, you get the Latin Kings, you get the Bloods.
You're talking gangs for people who may not be aware.
You get all the gangs. You get a combination of everything and people that's on the run, people from different walks of life, and they all wind up in this place and create a community.
You talk about how supportive and hardworking your mother is.
Yeah.
Was and is. So how did you get caught up in all that?
It was unique because my mom worked two jobs and I saw her work and I just felt like she didn't get the results that she deserved. And her two brothers was in the streets, you know, hustling and doing all these things. And those was my uncles. That was the father figure that I had, the male role models. And I was exposed to that game early. As a 7, 8, 9-year-old, seeing the money come, seeing the income, and seeing the flashy jewelry and things like that, I was like, man, that's the life I want. That's what I want. And what I saw her going through, I didn't want that. I didn't want that for me in the future. I didn't want that for her now because I saw how hard she worked.
You had a lot of close calls even then. I mean, as I recall, you recount in the book how you were arrested, what, like 9 times before you were even
9, 10 times.
Before you were 15, kind of lost even track. And apparently none of that was enough to make you stop. So what was the thing that made you say enough?
I think it was, you know how like a lot of people plant seeds. You have the chief of police who was an African-American male. You had the local community center guy, you had the NAACP activist, and you had my mom, you had my grandmother, you had different family members that influenced me to do positive things. And once I got incarcerated and I was in solitary confinement by myself for 23 hours a day, I got stronger mentally and physically, and I got out of that environment, so I was seeing things a little differently. And I think it just hit me all at once. And I was just like, man, I don't want to live this life no more. I don't want to do this. I lost friends in this, and I know the outcome. Either I'm going to have to hurt somebody, somebody's going to hurt me, or I'm going to spend the rest of my life like this, incarcerated.
Mm. You describe one other really interesting encounter in the book that I wanted to ask you to talk about, which is where you were no longer involved in dealing or any other criminal activity. You were, in fact, working at Burger King, going to school, playing basketball, trying to live right, and you were at home with the flu one day. And tell me what happens next.
So I'm at home sick, and I hear boom, boom, boom. I look out the window, see the police, ATF, SWAT team, everything out there. So I hurry up and just, you know, try to protect myself as they coming up the stairs and stuff, and I'm in the middle of a raid. And I'm just like, man, I hope it's not anything in this house that can lead me back to going to corrections. And after they have everything in the house secure, they go to the garage and they find a little bit over an ounce of cocaine. And they say, bingo, we got it. And I'm handcuffed and I'm sitting there and I'm just like, man, that's not my stuff. Sergeant Geller, I know him as Sergeant Geller now because we're good friends. Sergeant looked at me. They said, look, we got enough to convict him, take him. And if I was convicted, I was facing 10 to 15 years. Sergeant Geller said, let him go. He showed me tremendous favor. And I'm forever grateful because of that.
Why do you think he let you go?
Till this day, I ask him, why didn't you charge me that day? I still, like, I'm searching for that answer myself. Why didn't you pursue that charge? And he was just like, I knew you wasn't guilty. The informant had said that it was drugs being sold out this house. And they described the individual. And you weren't the individual that they described. So how can I try you for this?
But he could have. I mean, the fact is you did have a record, an extensive one at that point,
yes,
for drug dealing. You're the only one home. And it's your house. And the fact is, because it was in your house, there were charges that could have been brought.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think that's generations of prayer. My grandma said to this day, there ain't nothing but God. And I don't take that for granted. And because of that favor that I was shown that day, I was able to pursue my dream and live my life.
I was going to ask you about that. We are in a moment where relationships between law enforcement and many people are very tense. And it goes both ways. I mean, there's a lot of resentment on the part, I think, of law enforcement about how they feel that they are perceived. And there's a lot of resentment on the part of particularly, I would say, black men and boys and others about how they feel law enforcement has treated them and historically and treats them now. And I just wondered if you, what you feel your, this particular and powerful encounter that you had with now Lieutenant Geller, what should we draw from that?
That all cops aren't bad. I had a perception of police officers as a youth coming up. It's like, we don't need them out here, you know, doing what they do to us, you know, jumping out on us all the time, running us out of our neighborhood and doing stuff like that. But at the same time, you know, it was the reason behind that madness. I was selling poison. I was doing things to, you know, create the attention that I was getting. That was self-inflicted. And Detective Geller, this guy showed me tremendous favor where he could have just threw me to the wolves and gave me 10 to 15 and I'm gone. And it's only right that I talk about this relationship and this favor that this one officer showed me, and that, like, all officers aren't bad people.
Caron Butler, two-time NBA All-Star, starting his, what, 14th season? 14th season in the NBA, currently with the Sacramento Kings. His book, which is co-written by Steve Springer, is called Caron Butler, Tough Juice, My Journey from the Streets to the NBA. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Caron Butler, thank you so much for speaking with
us. Thanks for having me.